In this episode of Inland Visions, we're heeding the call of the mountain, but not just any old mountain. Behind me here is Elbrus, Europe's tallest peak, where people from all over the world come to test their mettle. And now it's our turn. So join us if you dare. Ruslan, they say that no one climbs a mountain accidentally. It's a weird phrase, but how do you tell if someone's ready to take on a peak like Elbrus?
If we talk about the preparation process for climbing Mount Elbrus, there's one very important marker. It's how you acclimatize to high altitude when you reach 4,700 meters. Judging by your condition when you reach this point, you're either ready or not. Before that height, it's pure guesswork. It's impossible to predict whether you'll be fit to climb. Some people seem to be going so slowly during the initial stages of acclimatization, but then reach 4,700 meters and eventually go on the top. It's surprising, but it happens.
Well, talking about acclimatization, what are the first signs of altitude sickness?
Here, near Mount Elbrus, hotels are located at 1,500 to 2,000 meters up. People who've never been at high altitudes before, office workers from the city, for example, find themselves in an unfamiliar environment. There's less oxygen here than what they're used to, and they find themselves panting. Their breath gets short even when they climb a flight of stairs. As a result, they may have trouble falling asleep.
Like me last night.
Right, it's another sign. But then your body begins to adapt. When you get to about 3,000 to 3,500 meters, you might get a headache because the atmospheric pressure is different. And that's it. These are the initial signs. But they can get more severe with greater exposure. You might feel dizzy or nauseous. You might have a frequent urge to go to the bathroom. There's one rule, though. If you feel sick, you need to go down. If you continue climbing when you still have symptoms of altitude sickness, it could end badly.
If you had to write three golden rules for a successful summit, Ruslan, what would they be?
It would be hard to say off the top of my head. Rule number one is probably that you have to be physically fit. Getting to the summit of Mount Elbrus is not like, say, climbing the stairs to the 300th floor. So being in good shape is key. I'd suggest running, doing CrossFit and cardio workouts. You need to be physically active. Rule number two is you need the right guide. If it's your first time in the mountains and you've only watched some videos on YouTube, I'd say you're still incompetent.
It's dangerous.
Yes, everyone has their own way of doing things. Just reading online, you'll come across some incompetent stuff, and it could have unpleasant consequences, even critical ones, like getting frostbite, etc. So you need to choose the right guide. You should read reviews and get some feedback from people who know them, who have used their services before. Rule number three has to do with less tangible things. I'm talking about your attitude. When people come to climb Mount Elbrus, we usually start with a big opening event, and I ask the guests what their goals are. When someone says, "I'll get there at any cost," I make a mental note for myself. The mountain, even though it's not a living thing, will give this person, metaphorically speaking, the thrill of his or her life. And you may never reach the top because your attitude can affect your reality. Others say, I'll see what happens. I'll just give it a try. I love the word try, especially in relation to mountain climbing.
What draws you to the mountains?
I believe it all starts with the people and pushing yourself to the limits, making yourself suffer to a certain extent.
Mountain climbing is like active meditation. You're walking, thinking how to keep your breathing evenly, where to put your feet, how to get your crampons to hold. You filter out everything that is unnecessary. You get away from the noise. If you want to get to the summit, your consciousness and your worldview should be just as expanded as the view from the mountaintop.
So what emotions do the mountains give you that, say, the city doesn't?
Let me put it this way. It feels like home.
What brings me personally to the mountains is that they give me a chance to be alone with myself and with nature, to listen to myself. We often lack that in our lives because we're surrounded by information and noise all the time.
You can compare it to a psychedelic experience. When you're climbing, you're challenging yourself. Physical exertion unlocks your unconscious. It's like looking at your life from a distance. You see everything without filters. It's about integrity. Mountains help you connect with your real self.
But that connection doesn't come without risk. Any misstep up there, like ignoring deteriorating weather or not acclimatizing properly, can have very serious consequences. Let's find out how to stay one step ahead.
Alexander, the weather on Elbrus and around the mountain can change in a matter of minutes. What are the earliest signs of bad weather that a rescuer can pick up on?
One of the main signs of an abrupt weather change on Elbrus is the formation of dense clouds above the summit. Sudden wind changes from valley to mountain and back. White clouds suddenly turning black. Elbrus is quite a big mountain, a huge mass, which has an impact on the climate around it, which may be different from the weather in neighboring areas. These are the key signs. Weather on Elbrus can change very rapidly.
I can imagine that as a climber, when you've been training for months, you're approaching the summit, the urge to continue to push on despite bad weather conditions must be overwhelming. How do you explain to climbers that swallowing their pride, the disappointment of not summiting, could save their life?
Anyone wanting to climb to the top needs to understand that getting there is not enough. You must get back. Therefore, yes, there are times when you need to use your best judgment, assess your resources, and maybe stop your climb in order to make it back alive and well. That's very important. Many people, especially when they suffer from altitude sickness, which is one of the dangers of Elbrus, lose their critical thinking skills. Someone might sit down thinking they're fine, but in reality, they're slipping away. You must be aware of the danger.
And of course, any call-out carries a certain level of risk. To you guys, the rescuers, when do you decide to turn back?
Unfortunately, it does happen sometimes that we just can't do it. We may be unable to get to a person or group. We're ordinary people just like everyone else. If there's an emergency at an altitude of 5,000 meters, we can't get there in the blink of an eye. We always work against distance and time. We need time to get there and provide assistance. Sometimes, if the weather is too bad, we can't approach. We've had such incidents, and people have died. We tried to push through to them, but we couldn't. We're only human. Yes, we're prepared and equipped, but we're only human.
And what's the most common mistake you see among beginners looking to climb Elbrus for the first time? What's the one golden rule that you would tell them?
The most typical mistake is not sticking to the acclimatization schedule. You can't change how your body works. There's not much oxygen up there. A successful climb to the top requires 7 to 10 days of acclimatization, no less. Another mistake is underestimating the route. Climbing Elbrus requires trekking, not mountaineering, and yet this mountain is challenging and dangerous to ascend. You have high radiation levels, abrupt weather changes, fissures. Your equipment might not be adequate. All these things matter and could potentially force you to end your ascent, or worse, injury or even death could occur.
So I've been given all this equipment, but it's not much use if I don't know how to use it. Can you please help me?
Let's start. Your clothes are okay for a mountain climb. You have everything you need, and this is the equipment we use when we begin high-altitude acclimatization and during the ascent itself. We'll start with mountaineering crampons. Okay. We usually keep them in a bag. They're for walking on hard snow or ice. We also have safety harnesses. When we're in a place with safety rails installed, we can attach it to them so that even if we slip, we won't go tumbling down. Let me show you how to use it. It's really easy. You just make sure these straps don't cross. Everything should be neat and straight.
Looks okay to me.
This is the back. This is also the wide back part. This is where the safety lines are attached using two carabiners. It's easy to put on.
Thank you, Roma.
Let me help. Okay, that's it. Tighten it.
And above the coat.
Yes, perfect.
There we go. Roma, we're quite high now, and I already feel quite tired. I'm breathing heavily. I've only done a bit of walking. What sort of fuel, food, do you use to keep your energy up in the mountains?
We mostly eat high-calorie foods, and we make sure to include meat, fruit, and vegetables. Sugar is a must to keep your energy up. Isotonic sports drinks work well too. When we keep moving for a long time and get hot, our bodies lose a lot of moisture and with it, a lot of minerals and salts. So it's important to stay hydrated and replenish your electrolytes.
Is it true that you put salt in water sometimes?
If you melt snow for drinking water or cooking, you absolutely must add salt or special pills containing minerals. That's because meltwater is considered dead. It's like distilled water.
And how much more calories does the body burn at altitude when you're climbing?
You can burn 2,000 to 3,000 calories in one climb,
really?
Yes.
And does the body change how it metabolizes fats and glucose?
When you experience hypoxia at altitude, your body starts using all of its available resources. Even at about 3,000 meters, just sitting down and relaxing is like mild cardio.
Really?
From that altitude on, your body begins to burn through its resources. As you can imagine, if you keep walking for 5 or 6 hours straight at an altitude of about 5,000 meters, your body uses up everything it has at its disposal. That's why it's important to stay hydrated, add minerals to your drinking water, and keep eating. Protein bars and other protein-rich products are very helpful for replenishing the energy we burn while climbing. That really is key. So, Peter,
look at that.
We're ready to start walking.
Excellent.
We usually wear hard hats when climbing a mountain. They come in handy when we get to the second slanted ledge where safety rails are installed. If you slip, your head should be protected. Here's how we put it on and fasten it. Here's how we put it on and fasten the strap. Looking good. Now, telescopic poles. You can adjust the length.
And these help with balance.
Yes. First and foremost, they help you distribute the load evenly when walking, which helps a lot. It's much easier to walk with poles, both up and down a slope. Poles are a must.
Okay, that's quite comfortable, yeah.
You can adjust the length as you like.
Yeah, okay.
This is just to give you a general idea.
The ice pick. I hope I won't need this.
We also use ice picks when we get to the top. Before climbing, we always do ice and snow practice with our guests so that they learn how to stop their fall if they slip. That can save your life. Anything could happen, so you must be prepared. Even though we have safety harnesses and everything, you should always remain focused. And getting down is just as important as reaching the summit.
Well, Roma, thank you very much for such a thorough walkthrough of all the mountain climbing equipment. Thank you.
So now we know, at least in theory, how to conquer a mountain, we decided to find out more about Elbrus. And there was no better person to do that with than Alina Piekova, who's reached its summit 3 times and climbed all 14 of the world's 8,000ers.
Alina, tell me about your first summit on this very mountain, Elbrus. How did you feel?
My first summit was Elbrus. It was back in 2018, and I was just curious. I wanted to get to the highest peak in Europe. We have so many people who come here every year to climb it, so I thought, I live right nearby. Why don't I try it? That's how it started. When I first went up, the weather was extremely good.
Are there any rookie mistakes that you made back then that you would never make now?
At first, I didn't quite realize what pace was comfortable for me. A mistake I often notice is people trying to walk too fast, which results in early onset altitude sickness. It can get really uncomfortable. So you should know what your body needs, but it comes with experience and time.
So Sherpas are known to be well adapted to high altitudes, and some even summiting Everest without oxygen. You're from a mountainous region yourself. Do you feel that that gives you an advantage over people from lower altitudes, like, say, Moscow or St. Petersburg?
I do feel a certain advantage when I'm in the mountains, but I have many friends who are successful mountain climbers. They don't use oxygen. They're very impressive. Despite that, they grew up in flat areas. It's hard to say how much of a factor this is. Sherpas are a different breed altogether, in my opinion. Their bodies are unique. They have a great advantage. They're in their element. Few people can match their endurance. There are those who grew up in the plains but still excel in mountaineering.
Now, in the Himalayas, Sherpas sometimes perform religious rituals to ask for a safe passage up the mountain. Are there any traditions or something similar here in Elbrus?
Sherpas have a crucial ritual called puja. They don't climb if they don't perform it. They need this blessing, etc. They really take great stock in it. I personally tend to think this is a private matter. We all have different religions, and each person reaches out to his or her God. I try to trust my instincts, which work really well in harsh mountain conditions. I listen to myself, but otherwise, I'm not a superstitious person. If I realize the weather is bad and we can postpone the ascent till the next day, then I take it easy and wait, definitely. I listen to my inner voice.
Mm-hmm. And not take any risks?
Yes.
They say that it's not the ascent that's the most dangerous thing, it's actually coming down the mountain where people find themselves in trouble most frequently. Why is that?
Statistically, that's true. It's because people put all their strength into climbing. So when it's time to go down, it feels harder and the weather might change. I agree that descent is more difficult and dangerous, especially if you don't use oxygen. You need to be super careful.
Have you ever found yourself in a situation where you've had to help someone come down off the mountain and maybe risk your safety?
Well, there have been situations like that. When we were coming down off Mount Everest, there was a Malaysian guy in our party. He was quite experienced. But something weird happened and he got sick. So he had to be brought down. My Sherpa was helping him as well. The Malaysian climber was lucky because normally it's very tricky to get someone down from that altitude. But everyone rallied around him. There's even a video online where you can see Sherpas bringing him down on their backs. He was wrapped in a bundle, and the Sherpas took turns carrying him down.
Yes, yeah.
It was a unique situation. People halted their climbs and risked their lives to help a fellow human being. Such things happen, but it's still very dangerous. You just never know if the right people are around when it matters.
Yeah.
It can end in tragedy, which is what usually happens.
A particular rescue that stands out in your memory where, despite the odds, you pulled a climber out of a desperate situation?
A couple of years ago, a group went up the mountain. The average time to the top is 10 hours. Those guys, however, took almost 18 hours to get there and had to go back in the dark. That was the first time I saw people with glassy eyes. They were like zombies. They could barely walk. There was also a blizzard. We were called up to help them down. I still see those eyes in my dreams sometimes. They weren't even blinking. That's how exhausted and cold they were.
Right, I'm not gonna lie to you. Today was a lot tougher than I thought it was gonna be. I've had a slight headache most of the day, and I'm absolutely exhausted. So it's time to get some rest and see what tomorrow brings.
Well, I made it this far, to an altitude where the air thins and every step is an effort. And after a long night, I realized that it just wouldn't be wise to push on. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we can't still conquer Mount Elbrus.
Ruslan, having talked to you and other people here in Elbrus, I've realised that I'm nowhere near ready, physically or mentally, to take on anything like that peak there. But I would still like to take our programme to new heights, quite literally. So here's something I prepared earlier, and I would be grateful if you could plant the flag of our programme on the peak of Elbrus.
Cool.
Excellent.